given the fact that we've been talking so much about the exit problem seeing that Hugh is a lot more like Rorty and Goodman than I thought he was. Hearing from him that he doesn't have an historical bone in his body, I thought that I would take us back to the origins of pragmatism and then place Hugh within the great debate of pragmatism and land him, if we have time in the discussion, with all the problems that accompany that view. So as I say, this is the history of pragmatism. I'm writing a big book on it, and I need to put Hugh in his place anyway. So this is very 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 presentable. So in the early to mid 1870s, William James started to argue that if one needs to believe something, then one ought to believe it, even if there is no evidence in its favor. It's not easy to unwind the various things that James said about what he called the will to believe, but one thing is clear. He was initially tempted to put forward a very strong point, and despite the refinements he was eventually to make, his is the most contentious version of pragmatist indispensability arguments. Most importantly, it set the stage for how pragmatism was to evolve. In some remarks made in an 1875 review in The Nation, and in the penultimate draft of The Will to Believe, James argues that given the dearth of evidence for or against the existence of God, if believing in God makes me happier, then I have a duty, he said, to believe in God. He makes a shockingly strong point. Anyone to whom it makes a practical difference, whether of motive to action or mental peace, is in duty bound to it. Chauncey Wright, the unsung third founder of pragmatism, along with James and Peirce, was appalled by this idea. He laid in wait for an opportunity to have what he thought was a much-needed duel with his friend over the matter. It's worth quoting extensively from Wright's account of those interactions. I have carried out my purpose of giving Dr. James the two lectures I had in store for him. I found him just returned home on Wednesday evening. His father remarked in the course of talk that he had not found any typographical errors in William's article. I said that I had read it with interest and had not noticed any typographical errors. The emphasis attracted the youth's attention and made him demand an explanation, which was my pre-mediated discourse. He fought vigorously. On Friday evening, I saw him again and introduced the subject of duty of belief as advocated by him in The Nation. He retracted the word duty. All that he meant to say was that it is foolish not to believe or try to believe if one is happier for believing. But even so, he seemed to me to be more Epicurean, though he hates the sect, than even the utilitarians would allow to be wise. James altered his position in light of this onslaught. When The Will to Believe was finally published 20 years later, he argued that one has a right to believe ahead of the evidence if one is happier for believing. All readers of James will know that at times he argues that there is a class of beliefs so important that we can't wait around for the evidence to come. Whether to believe in God is one of those forced beliefs, he said. We have no choice but to act, and so we need to go on our passions. But this interpretation runs up against both James's duty to believe inclination, which we've seen was very firm, and the other examples he gives of situations in which we need to believe. One non-momentous, non-forced situation in which I can will to believe is when I have no evidence for whether Mary likes me or not. If I believe that she does like me, then it is more likely that she will, and I will reap the benefits. So I should believe. He also speaks of an alpine climber who needs to jump across a chasm James argues that he should believe that he can make it, for that belief increases the likelihood of a successful jump. James, that is, takes it as generally unreasonable to be committed to self-fulfilling defeatist prophecies, where the belief that one will fail ensures or encourages the failure. For the very idea of truth, or warrant, for James, is tied up with our interests and passions. All beliefs are made true by being good or prudent or beneficial to believe. That is the very radical nature of James's proposal. He could not be more clear than in the preface of the book, the volume, The Will to Believe, when it was finally published 20 years later. He says, "If religious hypotheses about the universe be in order at all, then the active faith of individuals in them, freely expressing themselves in life, are the experimental tests by which they are verified, and the only means by which their truth or falsehood can be wrought out. The truest scientific hypothesis is that which, as we say, works best, and it can be no otherwise with religious hypotheses." James dedicated the book, The Will to Believe, to my old friend Charles Sanders Peirce, to whose philosophic comradeship in old times and whose writings in more recent years I owe more help than I can express or repay. Peirce owed rather a lot to James, who tried vainly to keep his difficult friend in academic work, and Peirce was touched by this dedication. Nonetheless, he doesn't have much good to say about James's essay. He writes to James, "I thought your will to believe was a very exaggerated utterance, such as injures a serious man very much." He scorned what he took to be James's view. "Oh, I could not believe so-and-so because I should be wretched if I did." Peirce was himself very interested in the indispensable, but he disagreed with James's idea that if we need something to be true, that warrants us in believing that it is true. Here is the key passage from Peirce's The Fixation of Belief, in which he knocks down every way of fixing belief but the scientific method of paying attention to experience and reasons. "A method," Peirce says, "is a failure if it makes of inquiry something similar to the development of taste. For taste, unfortunately, is always more or less a matter of fashion. And I cannot help seeing that beliefs will be greatly determined by accidental causes. Now, there are some people, among whom I must suppose that my reader is to be found, who, when they see that any belief of theirs is determined by any circumstance extraneous to the facts, will from that moment not merely admit in words that that belief is doubtful, but will experience a real doubt of it so that it ceases to be a belief." Peirce's point is that a genuine belief, our practice of believing, a belief is such that it resigns in the face of recalcitrant experience or in the knowledge that it was put into place by a method that did not take experience seriously. This is his way of trying to get out of the room. Indispensability comes into Peirce's position in the following way. He thinks that there are regulative assumptions that we have to accept. For instance, we must assume that, in general, our observations can be explained and that there are real things whose characters are both independent of our beliefs about them and can be discovered through empirical investigation. A related assumption, he thinks, is that for any matter into which we are inquiring or arguing or deliberating, we would find an answer to the question that is pressing in on us. Otherwise, it would be pointless to inquire into the issue. He says, the only assumption upon which we can act rationally is the hope of success. Thus, the principle of bivalence, for any P, P is either true or false, rather than being a law of logic, is a regulative assumption of inquiry. There is no claim here about special logical status, that the principle of bivalence is a logical truth, nor even that it is true in some plainer sense, nor that the world is such that the principle of bivalence must hold. The principle of bivalence, Peirce says, is taken by logicians to be a law of logic, by a sultus, by an unjustified beep. He distinguishes his own approach from that of the transcendentalist. He says, when we discuss a vexed question, we hope that there is some ascertainable truth about it, and that the discussion is not to go on forever and to no purpose. A transcendentalist would claim that it is an indispensable presupposition that there is an ascertainable true answer to every intelligible question. I used to talk like that myself, for when I was a babe in philosophy, my bottle was filled with the udders of Kant. He had the critique memorized in both versions, memorized. He was a little bit Asperger's, Peirce. But by this time, I have come to want something more substantial. What Peirce wants to do is to naturalize Kant. He thinks of indispensability arguments in a modest, low-profile way. Not only should the fact that an assumption is indispensable to our practice of inquiry not convince us of its necessary truth, it should not even convince us of its truth. He says, I do not admit that indispensability is any ground of belief. It may be indispensable that I should have $500 in the bank because I've given checks to that amount. But I have never found that the indispensability directly affected my balance in the least. We must make these assumptions, he says, for the same reason that a general who has to capture a position or see his country ruined must go on the hypothesis that there is some way in which he can and shall capture it. So Peirce's view is that we are obliged to suppose, but we need not assert. A regulative assumption makes a claim about a practice and about what those engaged in that practice must assume in order for the practice to be comprehensible or to be carried out. His point, as I say, is a point about the successful continuation of a practical matter, whether it be making friends, preventing your country from being ruined, jumping a ditch, etc. If we want to succeed in these endeavors, we need to make the assumptions that allow the practice to go on. Our reason for making them, Peirce says, is driven by desperation. And if we are faced with an assumption without which we cannot continue a really important practice, we must somehow embrace it without believing it, he says, however destitute of evidentiary support it may be. If that practice is at the very heart of what we think makes us human, seeking right answers to our question, agreeing or disagreeing with others, even the very having of a belief, then these regulative assumptions are going to be hard to dislodge. Nonetheless, they are mere assumptions or hopes without which, it is true, the human world as we know it is imperiled. I'm going to skip to the next generation now, George Santayana and C.I. Lewis. George Santayana, student of James and pragmatist fellow traveler, wade into the indispensability debate in an illuminating manner. Like Peirce, Santayana holds that, this is a quote from him, in regard to the original articles of the animal creed, that there is a world, that there is a future, that things can be sought and found, and things can be seen and eaten, no guarantee can possibly be offered. I'm sure these dogmas are often false, and perhaps the event will someday falsify them all, and they will lapse altogether. But while life lasts, this faith must endure. Santayana was a wholehearted supporter of one of the central tenets of pragmatism. We have to start with where we find ourselves, laden with a body of belief which we cannot simply shed in light of Cartesian requirements for certainty. Try as we might to suspend beliefs that are in want of guarantees, life and the need to act get in the way of that suspension. Santayana is at pains to distinguish his position on this matter from James's. He notes that he, like James, makes use of the idea of what he calls the fundamental presuppositions that I cannot live without making. But Santayana does not infer from the fact that we have to accept some beliefs that we can choose the beliefs we should accept. James's view that sometimes, he says, faith in success could nerve us to bring success about and so justify itself by its own operation is a thought typical of James at his worst, a worst in which there is always a good side. And I think this thought of Santayana's applies very nicely to Rorty as well. Santayana and Peirce struggled mightily to articulate the good side of this thought. They both argue that we must accept the bulk of our beliefs, but always keep them open to recalcitrant experience and never believe them on grounds extraneous to facts and reasons. We can't just choose what to believe. Santayana could not be any clearer. He says, why does belief that you can jump a ditch help you to jump it? Because it is a symptom of the fact that you could jump it, that your legs were fit, and that the ditch was 2 yards wide and not 20. A rapid and just appreciation of these facts has given you your confidence, or at least has made it reasonable. Otherwise, you would have been a fool and have got a ducking for it. Echoing Peirce, Santayana thinks that experience comes by way of shocks to which we must pay attention. He says, in the tangle of human beliefs, one can distinguish a compulsory factor called facts or things from a more optional and argumentative factor called suggestion or interpretation. These compulsory factors, the shock of experience, and this is a riff running through the whole of classical pragmatism, is a check on what we can assume. C.I. Lewis was also James's student, and although he was only 20 years younger than Santayana, his engagement with the logical empiricists and his influence on his own student, Quine, provides an argument for thinking of Lewis as the bridge between classical and contemporary pragmatism. In the great debate between Peirce and James, he sides with Peirce, whose papers he says he lived with for 2 years upon arrival at Harvard as a faculty member. He says, when we determine truth, we determine that which is correct to believe and that upon which it is desirable, not merely desired, to act. Lewis is dead set against the abandonment of evidence and reasons to the vagaries of wants and needs. He calls his position conceptual pragmatism and offers us a pragmatic conception of the a priori. For Lewis, as with Peirce and Santayana, it is experience that is brute and compelling. He says, no conscious being can fail to be aware of that element in his experience which he finds willy-nilly, as it is and not otherwise. This is not a metaphysical account of the given, it's entirely laden with our beliefs and concepts. The a priori, on the other hand, is what is the uncompelled initiative of human thought. It is a conceptual framework or network of categories and definitive concepts. Such frameworks, he says, are peculiarly social products, reached in the light of experiences which have much in common and beaten out, like other pathways, by the coincidence of human purposes and the exigencies of human cooperation. They are not necessary, as Kant suggested. They are simply indispensable if we are to make sense of experience. The laws of logic, he says, echoing Peirce and foreshadowing Quine, are principles of procedure, the parliamentary rules of intelligent thought and speech. Definition, analytic truths, such as All Brothers Are Male, the categories that underlie science, such as absolute space and time, the laws of inference, are addressed to ourselves and represent no operations of the objective world, but only our categories of mind. They're subject to alteration on pragmatic grounds when the expanding boundaries of experience reveal them as not very good intellectual instruments. So Lewis, for instance, argues that there's several logics, each self-consistent under its own terms, and the choice of which to adopt is a pragmatic one, and he has the same view of the law of excluded middle as does Peirce. So here is how Lewis suggests we think of these supposedly indispensable assumptions. And the resonance with Quine, it will be noted, could not be stronger. Lewis says, "The whole body of our conceptual interpretations form a sort of hierarchy or pyramid, with the most comprehensive, such as those of logic, at the top, and the least general, such as all swans are birds, at the bottom. That with this complex system of interrelated concepts, we approach particular experiences and attempt to fit them somewhere and somehow into its preformed patterns. Persistent failure leads to readjustment. The higher up a concept stands in our pyramid, the more reluctant we are to disturb it, because the more radical and far-reaching the results will be. The decision that there are no such creatures as have been defined as swans would be unimportant. The conclusion that there are no such things as Euclidean triangles would be immensely disturbing. And if we should be forced to realize that nothing in experience possesses any stability, that our principle, nothing can both be and not be, was merely a verbalism applying to nothing more than momentarily, that would rock our world to its foundations." This is from The Mind and the World Order, written in 1929, long before Lewis's own students, Quine and Goodman and Morton White, bizarrely started to use these very thoughts against Lewis himself. They said he was not a nice man, says Morton White. And it is precisely Peirce's view of how we should regard what we find indispensable. A priori truths are not necessarily true, they are simply what would be what is indispensable to our worldview. They could be revised, but only at great cost to that worldview. So I want to turn now to some very brief and speculative thoughts about how the debate has unfolded. Although Quine started off calling himself a pragmatist, he soon grew wary of the label. Perhaps he wanted to seem not to be simply trumpeting his teacher's view, although trumpet Lewis's view he most certainly did. Perhaps he felt that James had captured the pragmatist flag and wanted to distance himself from the position that had attracted so much scorn from Russell, Moore, and others. Whatever the explanation, Quine abandoned the pragmatist camp, leaving the ground wide open to be taken over by a new Jamesian. That new Jamesian was, of course, Richard Rorty, who says that his view is more similar to James's than any of the classical pragmatists, who wanted to see no appeals to authority of any kind, including appeals to truth and rationality. "We are," he says, "now infamously to substitute the idea of unforced agreement for that of objectivity." It's no surprise that Rorty takes James to be his predecessor, for one way of thinking of Rorty's position is as follows. If human beings need to think P, or if those enrolled in my way of thinking P think P, then I ought to believe it. There's nothing to say about truth and warrant above that. Given that norms are human norms, there's nothing but play and irony left to adjudicate between them. There's no place for the check of experience. So in his terms, if you are operating in different conceptual schemes, your talk will slide past each other. Whereas Quine and Peirce thought that we were all part of the same conceptual scheme, to use Quine's words, all bound together by the fact that we had to act in the world and that we had to interact with each other and that we were all subject to the same kind of force of experience, which is characterized in an exceedingly broad way and can be mathematical and moral as well as the stimulation of sensory receptors as Quine thought. So Rorty is the new Jamesian. And some of those who styled themselves after Peirce are the new Kantians. And those include Habermas and Apple, who you'll remember in the 1980s argued that a pragmatic presupposition of communication is that we aim at and expect consensus in our deliberations and that we treat each other equally and with mutual respect. And they argued that these pragmatic presuppositions were necessary and non-contingent, so they went the Kantian route. And we've seen what Peirce would have thought about such transcendental shenanigans, as he calls them. So he's no longer drinking from the udders of Kant. And just to conclude, I'll re-articulate the Peircean view and then in just a sentence or two, say where I think Hugh fits in. So Peirce thought that we need to take seriously that which we need to believe, but we must not make the mistake of taking what we need to believe so seriously as to think that it's necessarily true or even true in some plainer sense. The future of pragmatism, I want to suggest, lies in this modest stance in which there are norms and standards, and they are norms and standards that grip us all. But these norms and standards come from within our own practices of inquiry, reason giving, and justification. They're not given to us by a direct conception of the world the way it is. They're not given to us by any kind of metaphysical representationalist picture. And they're not given to us by God. They are human standards held in check by the force of experience. And this was, as we've been talking about this morning, the motivating thought of, say, Peirce, Lewis, Quine, going the one way, and going in the other direction, James, Rorty, Goodman, and then I wonder now if Hugh is in that camp rather than the camp that I thought he was in so impressively by arguing against Rorty, that we need to think of something like truth as being what makes our disagreements engage with each other rather than glide past each other because we are all talking a different language. So that was a very quick whirlwind tour through the history of pragmatism, trying to put Mr. Price into it.